At the same time as large numbers of factories began to close across America, a new drug was created. It was made by a company that had been founded by Arthur Sackler. In the 1970s, Sackler had marketed the drug Valium to deal with the feelings of anxiety and loneliness in the suburbs. He had died in the 1980s. But in the mid-90s, his company released a new drug called OxyContin. It was a synthetic form of opium, and it was sold as a painkiller.
Nick, you don't mind if I get a cigarette?
And then she reached into her clever little purse shaped like a flightless bird, and she pulled out a clean needle and some clean, fresh heroin, and with a little smile, she injected it right into her bare little arm. This was a new twist. I felt myself go all cold and soft. I hated needles, and, oh yeah, did I mention? She had a gun trained on me.
Ah, that's better. I'm going away, Nick. Far away from here. Just stay where you are.
Okay, okay, baby.
Oh, that's a whole lot better.
Go ahead, baby. I've got nothing to lose. Like I told you at the beginning, I've reached the end of a road that turned out to go nowhere.
But then, workers who were being laid off as the factories closed found that they got more benefits if they were disabled. So they went to their doctors and said they were injured. And the doctors gave them OxyContin. They got their benefits. But they also discovered that OxyContin made them feel safe, in a bubble, protected from the anxieties and fears of the new post-industrial world.
Broken neighbor's window, got up late for school. Didn't eat your breakfast, crapped on daddy's chair. Showed your dork at recess, weed in the pool. You're in a peck of trouble, but you just don't care. Oh, you're chewing your bubble, oh, blow away your trouble. Oh, you're glad that you picked it, and now you're addicted. Rococo bubble, oh, opium gum.
In the 1950s, as the empire collapsed around them, the British government saw the intelligence agencies as one of the few ways in which Britain could still remain powerful around the world. In the public's eyes, the spies were powerful, glamorous figures, epitomised by James Bond, who proved that Britain still had global power.
More going on, right, Pete?
Well, yeah, you know, just as President Bush is poised to pop over to China for a crucial tête-à-tête with President Jiang Zemin, Chinese authorities, what do they discover? That the 767, the Boeing 767 private plane that we built here, special for order for President Zemin.
$767 million it cost.
Turns out to be bugged from stem to stern with satellite-operated listening devices.
What did you say?
Yeah, what? In the studio with us today is Drew Lucey, China hand for the National Security Agency.
Do you want a Kleenex or something?
It's just bad weather.
And Drew, hey, you guys caught a bug.
See, yeah.
That's what happened.
So.
And Drew has some remarkable tapes. Welcome to the show, Drew.
It's really an honor, Peter.
Well, you actually have taped conversations covertly intercepted from President Zemin's plane?
Really? Look, there's a spittoon right over there if you want to. Get on with it.
From the 767's maiden voyage with Jiang aboard, you bet we do. His bedroom, his bathroom, the kitchen, they were all bugged.
My kitchen is bugged.
We got a tape from all of these. Well, I'm not talking about insects,
I know.
Pal.
It's a comedy
this
show,
is
mister.
The real
Get on with
thing.
It.
Come on, Drew. Come on.
In reality, MI6 was full of communists who kept defecting to the Soviet Union, while MI5, whose job was to catch such traitors, hadn't caught one for years. A tough police chief from Glasgow was sent in to reform MI5, but the agents would only talk to him in Latin, which he didn't understand. He gave up and told his wife that it was like working in a madhouse. Then MI5 was told by the Americans that one of its own agents was also a traitor.
Surveyor of the Queen's pictures, Sir Anthony Blunt. He, of course, is here. Sir Anthony, if we are going to pick up...
MI5 asked Blunt if he was spying for the Russians. He said yes, he was. So to avoid embarrassing the Queen, they gave him total immunity from prosecution. and let him carry on working at Buckingham Palace.
The Negro is ticking under the picture. I've been listening to him while you're talking.
And he's is going. Indeed a clock.
Yes.
And the mechanism is peculiar because the actual time, if you want to know the time, you'll have to look into the eye.
Okay, let's take a listen to those tapes right now, and then you'll tell us what they mean, right?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay, here's the first one.
All right, it's the intercept from the bedroom. Try to translate here. He said, look at this bed, big and soft. In 1947, on the long march to Yunnan, I slept in the dirt, but hey, baby, look at me, Mao. That's a Chinese pun. It's a little hard to translate. You just sort of got it. Yeah.
John le Carré had worked as a spy for MI6. And the experience made him understand what this secret world was really about. That in a country whose power had collapsed, leaving only a drab, decaying reality all around, the spies had managed to recreate a magical world where they could go anywhere they wanted, bug, burgle, and even assassinate people without any fear of judgment or control, just like in the Empire.
There is something delicious about being told now, we're going to have to burgle that house tonight. And what we'll do is we'll have a policeman outside, and while the owners of the house are away, in case they come back, the policeman will say, I'm sorry, you can't come in, we've had a burglary report in your premises. And these larcenous instincts, which are put to the service of the crown, had a voluptuous quality in the sense that this was a necessary sacrifice of morality. I really believed at last that I had found a cause I could serve. I also longed for the dignity which great secrecy confers upon you.
What's that now? It's a little hard to see.
He's jumping on the bed.
What was that?
He was jumping on the bed, and he must have landed on the bug. Look, there's more. There's more here.
He seems very excited. What's he saying?
Oh, now, here the president's measuring the TV. He says it's 48 inches. That's the longest one he's ever seen. He's very happy. He says now, Vanna White will be almost as big as life.
Oh, that'll be good for the
Chinese. Okay, that's the end of the bedroom tape. Let's move on to the bathroom.
All right, now, what's he doing now?
Well, he's tested all 7 positions on the luxury shower head. He likes them all. He doesn't like the stingy one here. He's calling that the American water torture. He's got some sense of humor, that guy.
In America, the spies and their secret operations were also being used to maintain a fiction. Ever since the Second World War, the American government had been using the CIA to manipulate and overthrow the governments of many other countries. One of the most senior members of the US State Department, Hans Morgenthau, had given this hidden system of power a name. He called it the dual state. America had to do this, Morgenthau said, because of the harsh realities of power in the world. But it had to be kept secret from the people, because revealing it would undermine their belief in democracy and in their exceptionalism, a belief that was essential in the Cold War.
Okay, all right. Move on to the next tape. Move on. Come on. This is from the galley. President Chang is here talking to his chef.
Yeah, well, what's he saying?
He's talking about cooking food for President George W. when he comes to China. Chef wants to know what to cook. Jack says, doesn't matter. If George is like his father, he's going to throw it all up on the prime minister, and half an hour later, he'll be hungry again. That's kind of a Chinese sort of pun to it.
From the 1950s onwards, the CIA rigged elections, destabilized governments through fake information, and organized violent coups in Italy, Greece, Syria, Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, Indonesia, and Chile. In all, the United States ran covert operations to overthrow 66 foreign governments. And in 26 cases, they succeeded. Morgenthau believed that this secrecy was creating a dangerous time bomb at the heart of America. And in the mid-1960s, details started to leak out. One of the senior members of the CIA, Miles Copeland, revealed that he had been involved in organizing coups throughout the world, starting in Syria in 1951.
It seems to confirm from the inside many of the people's fears, worst fears, about the way in which American policy is conducted. For example, plotting to overthrow the Syrian government and others. Do you think that's a useful way of conducting a foreign policy?
Keith, I'm not going to make a moral judgment. I'm simply describing the way things are done. Yes. It is true. Now, let me finish. It is true that in many cases we would sit around in our attics of the State Department and we would have long discussions. Our government does not interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign nation. And we meant that from the bottom of our hearts. And then we'd say, but in this is one case where we have to. And so we had to try to decide how to do what it was we said was against our policy to do. And we did, in fact, interfere in internal affairs of many sovereign nations.
Wherever he walked, all hell broke loose. Across all the Orient, the flames of violence leaped. Was the quiet stranger the torch? 10,000 mysteries swirled about him. Wherever danger exploded, they found the quiet American.
Tell me now, how come?
That's all we got. I'm
how
sorry,
come it took the Chinese, Drew? How come it took the Chinese so long to discover the bugs when the report says that they gave off a strange whining sound?
Oh, well, that's real easy. You know, this Jiang guy is a famous whiner. He whines about the economy, whines about Taiwan, the Olympics, the Falun Gong. He's a whiner, whines all the time.
I see.
Only after he left the plane did they figure out that the whine's not coming from him.
I'll be darned.
Well, and in 1961, the CIA decided to overthrow a government in the heart of Africa, in the Congo. 200 years before, the Congo had been at the center of the slave trade. Millions of Africans had been forcibly taken down the river and shipped to America, where their forced labor fueled America's rise to economic power. Now, the country had been given independence by its old colonial rulers, the Belgians. But it was completely unprepared and had collapsed into violence. The CIA were frightened that the new Prime Minister, Patrice Lumumba, was about to turn for help to the Soviet Union. It meant that the Russians might take control of the giant copper mines in the south of the country. The copper was crucial to the new electronic systems and computers that the Americans were building. They were the foundations of America's new wealth and power. And the CIA helped Lumumba's opponents capture and kill him. And they helped install a dictator in his place. He was called Colonel Mobutu, whose brutal regime the Americans would support for the next 30 years. Rather than establishing a democracy, what the Americans had found themselves doing was continuing the instability that had been created by the old European empires. And then they did the same in Iraq. In 1963, agents from the CIA came to Baghdad to plan another coup. One idea was to secretly poison the communists in the government. But the country the British had created was by now so unstable that before the Americans could act, the Ba'ath Party mounted their own coup.
The streets of ancient Baghdad become the scene of a short but decisive revolution that topples the pro-communist government of Premier Abdel Karim Qasim, shown here on the right. A six-man military junta seizes power on a holy day, and within hours, the premier, who reportedly had executed 10,000 people, is himself shot.
But the American agents supported and helped the overthrow. They even gave one of the young Ba'ath Party members, Saddam Hussein, a list of communists in Iraq. Saddam Hussein used it to execute thousands, and it began his rise to power. He later ordered a feature film to be made about his heroic role in the coup. It was made by the British director Terence Young, who had also made the James Bond film, Dr. No.
What I don't understand is why are the Chinese treating this incident so casually? Yeah, I mean, they don't seem at all.
They're very conciliatory.
You know what they're saying in the news, maybe. No, Americans are not the only buggers on the block, you know?
What do you mean?
What?
Well, 80% of all the light bulbs in the White House are produced in China.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, they're sitting around right now in Beijing. They're laughing at the tape of W choking on the pretzel. One pretzel away from Dick Cheney. Jeez. I gotta go. Yeah. I really gotta go.
What did he say?
He says he's gotta go too.
Oh, okay. Well, so many people to bug and so little time.
When Deng Xiaoping died, the country he had created was growing fast, becoming more and more powerful. But those who took over knew there were threats. They were frightened of their people, because they knew that having got rid of the communist ideals, they were now totally dependent on the economic system that Deng had created.
Now, let's see, where was I? Oh, yeah. Oh, 4006, 4012. Ringle, ringle, coins when they mingle, make such a lovely sound. 2 guineas and tuppence and threepence and bob, make my ears tingle and keep my heart throbbing. Crowns and coppers, little eye poppers, can make my pulses pound. Coin in a column can make me ecstatical, denominational or alphabetical. Alphabetical, ringle, ringle, when they jingle, make such a lovely sound. Crunch it! You've had your call for the day, and there will be no more.
Begging your pardon, sir. I simply thought, sir, since it is Christmas Eve...
Since it is Christmas Eve, this would be a disastrous time for you, Cratchit, to find yourself without a position.
Oh, no, sir. Yes, sir, you're absolutely right, sir. Forgive me, sir.
If you spent more time tending to your job, you wouldn't have time to feel the cold. Ah, blasted help situation. You'd be wanting a feather bed and tea service next, you know. You never could... 4036. Ringle, ringle,
it's cold.
Mingle, mingle,
it's cold.
I love
it's frightfully cold.
Please, Mr. Scrooge, please. What months are cold, Mr. Scrooge? Copper,
it's cold.
Little eye poppers so can cold. Make my pulse
so frightfully cold.
Humbug is giving to charity. Orphans are pesty, and Christmas a parody.
That had brought with it the growing force of individualism. A force that had the power to eat away at all the collective ideals that had held the society together. And outside China, they were increasingly frightened of the global financial system run by the Western bankers. The paranoia and suspicion about the West had gone very deep into the minds of the new rulers. But for the moment, the money from the West continued to pour in, and their power grew further. At the end of 1997, Britain had agreed to hand Hong Kong back to China. During the negotiations, the British had insisted that Hong Kong should remain democratic. The Chinese were shocked by this. They said it was completely hypocritical, because the British had never allowed democracy in Hong Kong. It had always been an authoritarian system, controlled by a brutal and racist police force. The British government sent an envoy to negotiate with the Chinese. He was Sir Percy Craddock, who had finally accepted that the Cold War was over. But after the talks, Sir Percy announced that he agreed with the Chinese. The demand for democracy, he said, was difficult, because when the British ruled Hong Kong, there had never been any democracy. Sir Percy was not invited to the handover. And in the pouring rain, Prince Charles watched as the Chinese said goodbye to the British by singing them a Rod Stewart song, Rhythm of My Heart. And despite the Chinese triumphalism, the BBC continued the fantasy of the special virtues of Britain's empire.
China is certainly jubilant about the return of this 412 square miles of territory. And that jubilation is everywhere in Hong Kong. But as we've seen tonight, it isn't quite as simple as that. There's a genuine fondness for Britain's decent contribution here. Genuine fondness for the last governor, too. He's family, as one Chinese Hong Konger described it to me.
In 1998, the very thing the Chinese leaders were frightened of happened. The global financial system went out of control. It began in Thailand, where Western banks had been pouring millions of dollars into a property boom. Suddenly the bubble burst, and developers defaulted on their loans. Western investors panicked and rushed to get their money out. The crisis then spread all across East Asia, to Korea and Indonesia. In every case, the country's exchange rate crashed, causing economic chaos.
Indonesia's currency has collapsed, losing 80% of its value, and the economy is in ruins. With riots and looting breaking out across the country, there are fears that it's now on the brink of anarchy.
The IMF gave huge loans to try and stabilise the countries. For a moment, it worked. But then the currencies crashed again, as those dollars were used by Western banks to get the rest of their money out of the countries. It left the Asian societies in ruins. To the country's leaders, this was the old corrupt imperialism returning in a modern form.
Power corrupts. As much as government can become corrupt, when invested with absolute power, markets also can become corrupt when equally absolutely powerful. We are seeing the effect of that absolute power today, the impoverishment and misery of millions of people and their eventual slavery.
China managed to escape the crisis. But it seemed to confirm to the country's leaders that their paranoia about the Western conspiracy was right, that the West was prepared to use its economic power to loot and wreck the Asian countries, just as it had in the past. They decided that the only way to make China safe was to take control. The chairman, Jiang Zemin, instructed that all the dollars that China got from exporting their goods should be sent back to America and used to buy up the United States government debt. This would make the dollar rise in value, which meant that Chinese goods would be even cheaper. But it would also make interest rates in America low, which meant that people would borrow even more money from the banks and buy even more Chinese goods. It was a virtuous circle. What the Chinese were doing was using the money to create a safe bubble wrapped around the United States that would stabilize the system and so keep China safe. But in the process, the Chinese money would create the biggest consumer and property boom ever in history and lead America into a protected dream world that was increasingly detached from the reality outside.
Thank you, George. Now, Mark, let's go to Landfill, California, where the beautiful Roxanne Pavement, Dark Star of the Mandatory Entertainment Corps, awaits to talk to you.
I am unbelievably honored to be here at remote Indio Perdido Lake near the bank of the lusty Colorado River, where an earth-moving miracle is taking place as far as the eye can see.
What a piece of ash.
Yes, Mark. This is Panorama Land 2000, where all of civilization is being gathered together on a desert-contoured, climate-conditioned, and completely re-greened landfill. Wherever you stand, sit or lie in Panorama Land 2000, there will always be something new. As the nation cleans its drawers of the 20th century in preparation for the millennial year of century 2000, it is filling that you should return on the heels of the century. Naturally, it will be exciting to hear what you have to tell, and even more exciting to show your own story here as an example to others. Congratulations from Panorama Land 2000.
A worldwide production of the Century 2000 Corporation and Walter Dednow Enterprises.
All rights removed.
And that dreamlike state was going to have extraordinary consequences. Not just for America and China, but for the whole world.
The city's going through its worst sandstorms in living memory.
It swathed the city in this ochre colour, this blanket of
red dust. It's raining now, it's literally raining mud.
I mean, just look at it. I mean, this used to be just completely
full of the international press. I mean, there's still a lot of foreign journalists here, but just blown apart by the worst sandstorms that people say is in living memory. Watch the cable.
In 2003, America and Britain were preparing to invade Iraq. For George Bush and the Americans, the aim was to bring stability to the Middle East. But Tony Blair saw it in wider terms.
Okay, boys, batting practice. Who's first?
I am, Tony.
You're a batter? Okay, boy. Well, don't just stand there, boy. Hit it.
Hit it? I didn't even see it.
Come on, boy. We'll put a tiger on your team. Kellogg's Sugar Frosted Flakes. Great big flakes of corn sparkling with a secret sugar frosting. Either with milk or right out of the box, Kellogg's Sugar Frosted Flakes are packed with energy.
They're good.
Good? They're great! Okay, boy, let's try it again. Tiger on your team with Kellogg's Sugar Frosted Flakes.
It was part of a new kind of global intervention that was not like the empires of the past. Instead, it was a way of liberating millions of people from a brutal dictator, which would then allow them to become free, democratic individuals. But there were people in Britain who knew the strange origins of Iraq. How 80 years before, English administrators had gone there and created a highly unstable society rooted in false dreams of England's past. A group of six historians came to see Tony Blair. They explained to him the complex reality of the different groups in Iraq and how they could easily turn on the Western intervention. There was silence in the room. Tony Blair said, Saddam Hussein is an evil man who needs to be removed. and the historians left. Then the spies came to see Tony Blair. They told him that there were hidden weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which justified the invasion. But yet again, they were inventing a magical world of hidden threats. And the invasion began. By 2007, the war in Iraq had become a nightmare. In the past, the Vietnam War had caused chaos at home in America. Not just in the mass protests, but the cost of such a gigantic war had wrecked the American economy, with growing inflation and unemployment. The politicians had no idea how to deal with the economic chaos. And it, as much as the protests, had forced them to admit defeat and flee from Saigon. But now, with the Iraq War, there was no effect on the economy. And there were no protests. The reason was the Chinese money. The Chinese continued to buy up more and more of the American government debt, which meant that the consumer boom continued.
There's a lot of people in the Obama administration wondering when they should declare that China is a currency manipulator. Not child abuser, but it has kind of the same sort of sense internationally. They are manipulating their currency. According to the United States Treasury, and people have known this for years, including the Chinese government, they have kept the value of their yuan, their money, down by 40%. That makes exports to the United States and other large markets relatively cheap and makes imports from places like us really expensive. And we've let them do it because in exchange, they've done things like buy $1 trillion worth of our bonds and not say whether they're worth what they're paying for or not. It's just kind of like a quiet thing. You know, we'll keep our money really, really, really cheap and we won't ask you how much your money is worth. It's a deal, but it's falling apart. And the Obama administration is saying, look, we can do this. We can declare you a manipulator, and then there's all these sanctions, yada-da-yada-da. But we'd rather come to some other kind of understanding. If they float the yuan and it went up 10%, 20%, 30%, it would have a huge effect on world markets. All of a sudden, our stuff, the stuff that we still make, whatever's left, goes over there at a much more competitive price. And all those soccer balls made by Chinese prisoners suddenly become more expensive. They cost 18 cents a piece instead of 12 cents a piece or something like it. Or maybe you have to buy two fewer pairs of designer jeans a week. Whatever it is, it's going to get more expensive to live off of Chinese goods. But here's the problem. If the Chinese appreciate the value of their currency, it means that all of the pensions that they owe and all of the state allotments that they're committed to suddenly are costing them a lot more money, at least in relationship to the dollar. And if they appreciate the yuan, it relatively depreciates the U.S. dollar, of which they own a trillion. I mean, that's a lot of bucks. You can't walk out of that in suitcases. It takes years to get out of the room with that much money. And all of a sudden, it's going to be worth considerably less. Currency manipulation. How do we let this go on? How in the world do we allow ourselves to be manipulated by world currency? Good question. And here's the good news. I don't have an answer, but I'm going to find one.
And safe in their protected bubble, few of the American people protested. The war was far away and had no effect on their lives, which meant there was no pressure on the politicians to admit defeat. And that led them to try ever more desperate measures to achieve victory. But that desperation was going to awaken ghosts from the past that would return in a distorted and frightening form. Sheikh Abdul Sattar Abu Risha was the leader of one of the largest Sunni tribes in Anbar province outside Baghdad. He came to the Americans and offered to help them. In return for large amounts of money, he said, his tribe would ally with the Americans and create a militia to fight against the insurgents. Above all, against Al-Qaeda in Iraq. In desperation, the Americans agreed. And the idea quickly spread across the country. The Americans giving out millions of dollars to Sunni tribal leaders to create private armies. It was called the Awakening. And Sheikh Abu Risha became a heroic figure. When President Bush came to Iraq, he met the Sheikh to thank him personally for saving the Americans.
On September 14th, 2006, we have made our voice loud and clear. It was the tribals rising against terrorism. And we attacked Al-Qaeda, starting with Al-Anbar. And if they rely on us, we will be able to defeat terrorism and Al-Qaeda from throughout Iraq.
But what the Americans had found themselves doing was exactly the same as the British had done 80 years before. Faced by a complex society that they did not understand, they were turning to the tribes outside the cities and giving them power. They called the militias the Sons of Iraq. And it seemed to work. But in reality, it was going to lead to something even worse.
بالسلام الجمهوري.
3 years later, as the American troops prepared to leave Iraq, the money stopped, and the tribal leaders saw their power disappear. So they made a tactical decision. They turned and allied instead with the very people they had been fighting, the Al-Qaeda in Iraq jihadists. And out of that alliance, what had begun a long time ago as a make-believe version of England created in the deserts of Mesopotamia as the British Empire fell apart. And that mythical, romantic view of the past was also about to return at home in both America and Britain. And it was going to have powerful consequences there too. In his campaign, Donald Trump promised to recreate a lost America.
We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And we will make America great again. God bless you and good night. I love you.
But with the exceptionalism also came the fear and the violence. And in Britain, thousands of those who had been marginalised by the new global economy also came to believe in that romantic idea of England as a special place. A picture of a lost greatness that had been invented by the upper classes in the 1920s. Now, hundreds and thousands of frightened and angry people demanded that Britain leave Europe. And the old ruling class come back and turn that dream into a reality.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine.
Oh, that was so much fun.
Still tasting.
Last week, the four of us in the Firesane Theater were invited to a holiday fundraising event at the Rising Gorge. You've heard of it? California chef Mario Bastardi's newest West Side eatery.
Well, it was called a wine testing, since these vintages had been acquired haphazardly from yard sales of indicted CEOs and busted.comers.
Yeah, they were offered to us by the glass, cup, or hand, and they featured Peter Sellers' estate sale recorked sherries and half-drunk bottles.
Or a barrel, a can.
ask for a Little John from Sherwood Forest's Robin Hood wine,
which went from the rich to the poor.
I tested the Jekyll and Hyde Lab shards.
Sometimes they're good, sometimes they'll kill you.
Yeah, it did taste a bit doctored.
Hey, I decanted an unlabeled bottle of Flooded Cellars Mixmaster's Choice.
Ooh.
And I took sips from a six-pack of premium vintages like Michael Jackson Nubile Moonwalk Whites and the Cabernet of Dr. Caligari.
Spooky. Since I brought my boys along, I opted to stay with the theme park rosé, the fiddle-dee-dee Lakesbill Merlots, and the roller coaster reds, which made my head spin.
Well, then I went on to the Pinot Cinema Noir, but I passed out after the first sip and someone stole my glass.
For dessert wines, they offered any port in a storm.
And a Godfather Grappa.
Which we couldn't refuse.
Afterwards, we sat with the owner, Mario, for a photo op and nursed some Grand Canal sparkling sewage water.
While the great man caressed a snifter of rare Loch Ness Triple X 12-year-old girly 10 years to life chocolate malt scotch. Ooh.
I think we're all still nursing a hangover.
Well, here, have some hair of the dog, Phil.
Hey, pour me a Boxer's Rebellion.
Well, I would have a borderline collie.
For me, some Rot Gutweiler.
Ooh, that's got a fight.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl. Someday I'm gonna make her mine. Oh yeah, someday I'm gonna make her mine.